Hello, everyone. This is Stuart Weeda, your host for Energy Unplugged, along with Mark Denton, my trusty sidekick and humor man. And really would like to welcome everybody. We've got a fantastic guest today, Josh Israel of Hariba US, informally of the West Virginia Center for Alternative Fuels, Engines, and Emissions Group. And we're really excited to talk about how emission testing is done and how various things work in the automotive world and doing the proper things to make sure that we're cleaning up our air in the United States and doing the best we can to have a positive effect in that regard. Mark, how are you today?
Doing great. Good morning.
Good morning.
We're excited to welcome Josh. It's been a while since we've visited.
Right. Yeah, thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah, so welcome, Josh Israel. And Josh, Mark, and I were talking beforehand. Mark mentioned that the last time he was with you, he was around a bunch of people such as yourself, engineers and PhDs, and he had a hard time understanding how this stuff worked. But maybe we can put it down in layman's terms today.
Yeah. We'll get him on board. We'll get him up to speed.
Okay. Well, good. Well, Josh, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got started in the emissions testing field and some of the work that you do at Hariba?
Yeah, thanks. And thank you guys for having me today. Really appreciate it. Excited to be here. I got into emissions testing about 15 years ago, as you mentioned, at West Virginia University, who has been and continues to be one of the world leaders in emissions research from automotive sources, right? That Center for Alternative Fuels, Engines and Emissions got started, 30 years ago in the 90s, doing research on emissions from internal combustion engines, right? Among other things. I got into there in the early 2000s, the mid 2000s, around 2005, really as a technologist doing emissions testing. At the time, diesel engines were going through a lot of changes, right? That's when what we now call after treatments, those modern after treatment systems were all being developed. And I was a lot of the testing going on in our lab involved refinement of those systems. And that's how I got my start. Worked there for a long time, got into the engineering side and the administration side. And that's really what brought me here to Hariba, my current place of employment. Hariba is, I believe, the largest manufacturer of automotive testing equipment for emissions testing globally. In fact, for a long time, has been the gold standard there, right? About last time I checked the numbers, I think we had about an 80% market share globally in that emissions measurement space. So nearly everyone who's measuring emissions uses our instruments. And what I do for Hariba now is I'm in market development. So basically a lot of market intel, right? I get paid to go out and learn things and report them back to help us inform new products and develop strategy and execute those strategies. So clearly a big part of that is new emissions regulations. That's what drives a lot of the changes in how things are measured and what's being measured are those regulations.
Right.
I would call myself an expert, except that I've been in too many rooms full of experts to make that claim. But I think I know a lot, right? And I'm happy to talk to you guys about regulations and emissions testing and anything else you think might be interesting to you and your audience today.
Well, that's a really good point. That's what I wanted to ask you about, particularly going back to West Virginia, where you started your career in this area. Regulations often get a bad name. Many times they're onerous and unnecessary, but I think there's some validity to regulations on the emissions and the requirements. And it's proven itself in regards to forcing technologies to be developed and evolved and to reduce emissions in engines and many other areas. So without the regulation, would these companies be forced to do it? So could you go in a little bit at West Virginia, the role that they played in helping companies and engine manufacturers comply with the regulations that were put out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to your point you just made, you know, about those regulations drive advancements in technology, I think that's absolutely true. I remember seeing a quote at one point that, you know, without regulations, it's like you're playing tennis without the net, right? And they really do drive improvements in technology. Sometimes they might set the bar uncomfortably high for the people that are charged with making those engines and turning a profit off of them. But I think in general, they're a good thing, certainly for the environment, but also a good thing for society at large because they result in a better product. But yeah, in West Virginia, you know, for a long, long time, we were a research institute. My role there was to develop the first formal contract testing division within that organization. And, you know, Blossman was one of our big customers then, I believe still is at the West Virginia, at the university.
On that point, that's an interesting thing. It's one thing for engines emissions to be measured while they're in the lab, but it's taking a step further when you do it on an on-road basis. Maybe you could explain a little bit about that and get more real-world applications, let's call it.
Sure, yeah. And that's probably where West Virginia has innovated the most and made the biggest name for themselves is in this real-world testing regime, right? And so I think maybe a good place to start is that when the EPA certifies vehicles and engines for a long, long time, like from the inception of those regulations in the 70s, all of that testing was done in a lab. You know, large commercial vehicles, big engines were tested, the engine alone on a test stand, and passenger cars and, you know, light duty vehicles were tested as a complete vehicle, but in a lab on a dynamometer, which is basically just a big device for allowing the vehicle to perform as if it were on the road. The wheels are actually spinning. You can think of it like a giant treadmill for a car would be a good layman's term, right? And for a long time, that's the only way vehicles were tested. Then in the late 90s, what started to come around were portable emission systems that could actually be put onto a vehicle and you could drive it around in a real in-use case. And what was found very quickly, and West Virginia was one of the leaders there, was that there could be a bit of a disconnect between what you found in the lab and the actual real world emissions, right? For a number of reasons, right? One, because a laboratory can't really simulate all of the variations and conditions like weather that you find on the road. And two, because the duty cycles, in other words, the loading you were putting on the vehicle or how you were simulating that drive, was not always representative of how those vehicles were being used in use. You could think of the laboratory cycle like a one-size-fits-all suit, right? It was meant to test a vehicle in a very general way. And what you would find in the real world is that those vehicles are being used in lots and lots of specific ways that obviously a one-size-fits-all suit does not fit everyone. In fact, I would argue it fits no one perfectly, right? And same case with those duty cycles. So that's why there was a bit of a disconnect. The West Virginia lab was and still is one of those leaders in that real world type of testing. In fact, Hariba Instruments is one of the people that got in on the ground floor of developing those test measurement systems that would allow you to measure emissions in the real world setting.
Yeah, well, that was my question. I assume that Hariba equipment and the measurement tools that it brings to the marketplace were part of the process in making those advancements at West Virginia.
Absolutely, yeah. There was a lot of co-development on prototype stuff at West Virginia during my tenure there. Now those systems are very robust. In fact, there's, you know, the next generation of PEMS equipment has emerged that can help meet some of the new regulations. You know, in the United States now, the heavy duty manufacturers, so all the big engine manufacturers, Cummins, Volvo, Daimler, etc., right? They're all required to test their vehicles in use and submit that data to the EPA and CARB. The light duty pass car space is not currently, although, you know, the EPA and CARB has said, no matter what, we will take your vehicle out on the road and test it with these portable systems.
Right.
So it needs to be compliant in a real world space as well. But in Europe, they have very, very stringent and formal regulations to test every vehicle on road at the time of certification. It's called RDE, real driving emissions. And that's a really big deal. Yeah.
Yeah. That's part of the Euro 6 standards as they evolve to that. And the RDE, that's something that's a standard over there, not here in the United States just yet for the smaller, lighter duty vehicles, right?
You got it. That's exactly right.
Okay.
Well, so Josh, is there such thing as a clean diesel, or is that an oxymoron?
There's certainly cleaner diesel. Yeah, I think if the only thing we're defining as clean is zero emissions, then yes, there's no such thing as a clean diesel, right? It's amazing how much they've been able to do in terms of reducing emissions from diesel engines with advanced aftertreatments. But I think it's one of those things like clean coal that ends up being maybe more of a marketing term than a scientific term. And I think, if the only way we're defining clean, truly clean, is zero at the source, then that's a bar that no one can probably get over.
Well, and that's even one of the things that we've discussed in previous podcasts, Josh, is the zero emissions at a vehicle doesn't necessarily mean zero emissions. When you're talking about the EV, the electric vehicle, they are truly zero emission on the transport divide the vehicle itself. But where does electricity come from? So you have to look upstream as well and do a full fuel cycle, or in this case, a wells to wheels analysis. How does some of the work that VW and Hariba, where do they participate in doing those larger evaluations, or is that left up to the government laboratories like Argonne and other places?
Yeah, those national laboratories, Argonne, Southwest, right? Those are the places that are known for generating those big high-level emissions inventories. You know, the regulators do that as well, EPA, California Air Resources Board. And even as we get into electric vehicles, like electric vehicles initiatives, some of those bigger agencies are doing their own analyses. And you're exactly right. You know, there's zero emissions at the mobile point source, right, is how those vehicles are really defined. But as long as we're generating energy from fossil fuels in this country, there will always be a carbon footprint associated with an electric vehicle.
As is the carbon footprint associated with the lithium and cobalt and nickel mining that makes the battery technology going on these mobile EVs, right?
Absolutely right. Manufacturing processes, refining processes, delivery, et cetera, right? Yeah, as long as those processes stay in place, the true footprint of an electric vehicle is not going to really be zero.
That's part of the problem. It's fine to be aspirational and have a zero or net carbon world, net negative carbon world, but you have to take the whole process into consideration, not just the end user or the end device, in this case, the vehicle. So while you were at West Virginia, you were right in the middle of one of the most controversial emissions issues in the history of our country, which is the Volkswagen diesel issue that I guess sometimes was termed Dieselgate.
Right.
That scandal, your team was really in the midst of it in terms of the testing and exposing some of the things that were going on. Do you have anything to share in that regard?
Yeah, that was, you're right. That was right in the middle of my time there. A couple of very bright researchers, guys who are still at the university, had been contracted by a group called the ICCT, the International Council for Clean Transportation, really to demonstrate that diesel passenger cars were a really good technology, for particularly for urban areas like Los Angeles, right? Very congested, high population density urban areas, right? They wanted to demonstrate that diesel vehicles were a clean solution there. And what they immediately found was that, you know, some of those vehicles performed very well, but the vehicles that were being produced by Volkswagen in this country, there seemed to be a major problem. I mean, in some cases, they were 40 to 50 times higher emissions rates than what was advertised, right? Than what was certified. And all this has been, you know, very well and publicly documented. But it became clear there was a problem. And in fact, our first reaction when we had run all those tests as a lab was, man, we must have really screwed this up. You know, because there's no way that we've got this wrong.
Right.
So those guys repeated all of their testing and got the same results. And then we reported back to the ICCT, right? West Virginia reported back to the ICCT those findings. ICCT found that very curious and actually paid another group, I believe, to replicate those results, which they did. And at that point, they got, you know, a duplicate result from multiple sources. That's when the ICCT really went to the California Air Resources Board and others and said, we believe we have a problem here. And, you know, the rest is history. That became arguably the largest emissions scandal in the history of the automotive industry. And has led to pretty sweeping changes in regulations. You know, you just mentioned those RDE plus regulations that are part of Euro 6. I think those are born directly out of that Volkswagen scandal that happened. I think it's changed a lot of the way things are tested in this country, and certainly how things are looking at. And it's really shown a spotlight on those real world emissions and tried to identify the gaps between the real world and the lab and close them.
But that's the great thing. We don't make progress if we don't identify the issues or the gaps or where there's areas of improvement. And I think it's the coolest thing in the world. It happened at West Virginia University. It not only had implications in the United States, but I would say globally. And as you're familiar with, in Europe, they were going full bore with diesel on passenger vehicles over there and had been for nearly 20 years. And they completely turned in the other direction. So, I mean, there was a great old West Virginia. My wife is Virginia, and they sort of get snarky about people over in West Virginia.
Yeah, and vice versa. Yeah.
And vice versa. Yeah, exactly. It's like Alabama and Auburn football fans. You know, you just can't like one another.
That's right.
Why can't we all just get along here? But I think it's really an amazing thing that the technology group that you all had at West Virginia was able to make that type of impact and identify something that we need to, not just here in the United States, but around the world, improve upon.
Yeah, I think so too. You know, my family's goes back in West Virginia for a couple hundred years, right? So I have pretty deep West Virginia roots, and it was a very big deal, you know, that all of that happening and those initial discoveries being made out of West Virginia. Really exciting time to be there. You know, I wasn't directly connected with it. As I mentioned, that was that team of researchers, but man, did it have a big impact on our lab and ultimately on the world stage. So yeah, exciting time.
Right. So what do you think is evolving now, given some of the things that have happened? Let's just call it over the last 20 years in particular. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things that's important to understand for a lot of folks is if you read a Bloomberg News headline and the front page cover says the internal combustion engine is dead, it's going away. And what a lot of folks don't understand, you know, if you take an engine from 1970 and compare it to an engine today, there's 99% less emissions coming out of today's modern engine. And with, you know, direct injection technology or production direct injected engines, do you have any views on some of those advancements? And for example, most recently at the direct injection engines, and maybe you can explain that for our listeners, are adding port fuel injectors back on top of them to even, you know, have a more positive effect on emissions. There, in other words, there are all kinds of advancements that continue to be made in the internal combustion engine to reduce emissions. Do you have any view on that and some of the technology evolutions that have happened in the last, I don't know, the last decade?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, personally, I still think there's still a lot of work to be done on the combustion engine and a lot of exciting things going on now. You know, you mentioned gasoline direct injection, which has become the most common mode of injection, I would say, for spark ignited vehicles at this point, right? And that's happened very quickly in the past 10 years, right? And port fuel injection is still around, but clearly GDI is becoming the dominant mode of those vehicles. And one of the things you just mentioned, you know, how are we putting port fuel back on? There's exciting stuff going on with, you could have a GDI and a PFI on the same engine, and they work in series and sometimes even in parallel, where you have both happening. The reasons because of that are largely driven by particulate formation. So I think your listeners are probably a smart group and know what particulates are, right? It's that black soot that comes out of your engine. When you use a gasoline direct injection strategy, you tend to generate more of that, right? You tend to generate more of that fine particulates coming out of your engine, right? And the way that you have to treat those engines is with a filter downstream. You know, the diesel has been filtering their engines as a standard for more than a decade. And now as GDI becomes common on spark ignited engines, they're talking about GPFs, gasoline particulate filters, to catch those same things. And the manufacturers are trying to look at new technologies, how they can mitigate those particulates without the use of a filter, right? For as long as they can, and maybe, you know, indefinitely. And that dual injection approach is one where you might use your port fuel injection at idle or during partial loads. At very high loads, you might be fully gasoline direct injection. And at mid-load, you might be a combination of both, right? And I believe it was Hyundai that presented publicly on this subject a couple of years ago at SAE World Congress, demonstrated you could get a reduction of particulates by about 50% with that kind of strategy while keeping your fuel economy about the same. So it's interesting things like that that are happening. But, you know, that's really just one of 100 different new technologies that are going on. People are looking at how you can operate very smart combustion, right? So you can do different types of combustion cycles, not just your typical auto cycle with a spark ignited engine, particularly one that's turbocharged, now that turbocharging has become common for spark ignition. Right. There's a lot of exciting things going on there, for sure. You know, a lot of EGR and some of those things that have been diesel applications are now coming to the spark ignited world with that direct injection, right? Lots of really exciting stuff going on there.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, at Alliance Autogas and the systems that we provide, we're really excited that we're being able to keep up with the direct injection developments. And even as we go forward to the turbocharging, as you mentioned. And a lot of companies have been unable to do so, but the changes in the modern engines and some of the exciting things that are happening are so important that we've got to keep up. And in fact, propane actually has some advantages over gasoline in those applications. Are you familiar with that at all?
I would say I'm familiar, but I'm not as familiar as you guys. I'd actually like to hear about it.
Yeah. Well, I won't bore you with those details, but it really has to do with the properties and the energy density, which is different than gasoline or petrol, but you have higher octane ratings and other things. But you mentioned something that I think is also important. You know, carbon seems to be the thing that everybody's obsessed with. Now, you know, 90% of the carbon dioxide emitted from the Earth comes from the Earth itself. And less than 4% is coming from humans or other human activity. But if you watch a Clint Eastwood movie from the 70s and you watch him driving down the highway and you see all that haze and that black soot, that's air quality, and particulate matter is to me, in terms of human health, in addition to climate health, it's really important to address the particular matter. And it sounds like what you've described is we've made tremendous progress in that regard with both diesel engine technology and gasoline internal combustion engines.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's almost like a two-headed approach to emissions, right? There's the things that directly impact human health, and particulates are one of those, right? You're actually breathing that ash and carbon, right? And that's one that, you know, everyone agrees on we need to get rid of. And that's one of the things that all of these advancements in the engines have done a great job of mitigating, right? And certainly propane engines are a big part of that.
But Josh, I think that's been a major reason that we've seen so many school districts go away from diesel buses for that reason right there. And they're going to propane buses for two reasons. They it's the particulate matter and the health emissions, but it's also the maintenance is becoming very difficult and very expensive on those diesel buses. We're being told that they're patches. They're not really permanent fixes on these diesel units. How would you respond to that?
What exactly is the comment there, Mark? What is the patch?
They're talking about the DEF systems and the regen systems. They're basically saying that the manufacturers of the diesel engines have not really solved the problem with technology, that this regen and DEF systems are a patch in order to meet the emission standards.
I also spent some time at Cummins Engines during my career. I worked there for about a year when I was in grad school out here in Indiana. And so I have a good feel for that technology. I worked there at a time when those aftertreatments were really becoming robust, right? When those were becoming standard and they were fully developed. So I'm personally a big fan of the aftertreatment, right? Like I like it and I feel personally engaged with it. That's an interesting comment to say that they're a patch because, you know, the emissions coming out of the engine are about the same as they were before the aftertreatment. And maybe that's more what's at the heart of that comment, right? Is that the engine is still producing about as much as it was. But those after treatments are the patch, if you will, that takes care of those emissions before they come out of the tailpipe.
You know, when I think about, let's just talk about a typical U.S. fleet manager that, let's just say, is dealing with primarily Class 3 through 7 vehicles. A big part of their mandate, if you will, is to have vehicles that will perform whatever it is they use those vehicles to perform. And so, you know, how would you speak to a modern propane engine in those markets, in those segments, you know, be to durability and long-term life of the engine and so forth?
Well, I like propane, right? And I'm familiar with your guys' product and some others, you know, through the PERC, through the Propane Educating Resource Council. I'm a big believer in this idea that a diversity of solutions is necessary, particularly in the near term, right? I think propane certainly has its place for all of the reasons you just said, that it's a very energy dense fuel. While being energy dense, it has a typically high octane number. So it is really good in terms of anti-knock, right? And probably lends itself very well to turbocharging, right? I would imagine. I would defer to the experts on your side, but based on what I know about propane, I think those are some great qualities to have when you're looking for a fuel. I know that you guys have done an amazing job with infrastructure development and deployment, and that's another big part of making a fuel and a solution economically viable. So, I'm big on propane as part of the solution for the future, no doubt.
Well, and to your point, Josh, it's something that I'm a strong believer in. We have to pursue multiple options to achieve our goals, whether they're air quality goals or our beliefs about greenhouse gas emissions and their impact on our climate. And you can't have a waste management truck driving around electricity and it make the full route and get out into the countryside with the range. But it might be a wonderful option for somebody driving 5 or 15 miles to work every day to have electric vehicles. So we need to pursue the best options for the, you mentioned duty loads earlier, or the operating profiles. And we need to improve all of the options that we have today. And do you have any view on these goals? The 2035, there'll be nothing but EVs. And that, do you think, do you have any perspective on that that you could share with us?
Yeah, you know, I like all of the thinking with those big sort of carbon neutral goals or 100% electrification goals, right? We're a company at Hariba, certainly, and myself personally, that believes in a green future. No doubt, we think we're going to get there. I've done a couple of interviews lately. I spoke to Automotive News not too long ago, and I think the best way to think about it is it's very easy to imagine a future where everything is electrified, right? Whether that's 50 years out or 15 years out, right? It's easy to picture it in your mind, but it's impossible for us to get there without what's existing today and some electrification coexisting for quite a long time while we make that transition in a smart way. I would be behind any organization that wants to go 100% zero emissions by some future date. But what's really interesting is when you get into the details of how you've got there. And that's what, you know, when I mentioned about a diversity of solutions and a diversity of fuels, I think that's where we get into those, that more interesting part of the details about how do we get there. And I'm also a person that believes that the internal combustion engine is never going to disappear, that there will always be a place where it makes sense, where it is the smart solution, and maybe way far off in the future, internal combustions will be a tiny little niche. But for now, they're certainly the most dominant form. They likely will be for quite some time for a number of reasons, right? And one of those reasons is that at the moment, they're still a good, clean, financially, you know, cost of ownership, sense-wise, solution.
Yeah, that's an important point. Maybe to use modern-day terms, economic justice. There mm-hmm. is a component to this with the energy density of fossil fuels and the maturity of the networks that to distribute it and process and refine it. That it has to be relevant in for a number of decades while we make this transition. And we also need to find other ways to generate electricity. I personally don't understand why there's objections to nuclear, which is the only emissions-free source of energy known to man right now. And if we figure out fission and other such things, we really might produce our electricity in a much better manner than we do today. And of course, we can't. There aren't enough rivers to dam globally or in the world or even in the United States to be like a Washington state or the Pacific Northwest, where they have a lot of hydropower, beautiful thing, but their impacts for every type of energy source right now. And we need to do the best we can to make the improvements in every particular area. So at Hariba, could you elaborate a little bit on some of the things that you are doing with electrified vehicle technologies?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Hariba Automotive is the division I work for, right? There's a number of different segments within Hariba Corporation large, but Hariba Automotive, you know, we are following the trends of the automotive industry, right? Those are our customers. We're listening to what their plans and needs are and adapting. So, you know, I think what we're known for is emissions measurement. That, like I said, you know, about an 80% market share in that space. But as that industry is going through this time of unprecedented change, we've tried to change too. On a big part of those, a big part of that puzzle for Hariba has been expanding through a couple of acquisitions. You know, in the about 3 years ago, Hariba acquired a company called Myra in the UK, which is a big technology park and proving grounds, engineering solutions and services provider, right? So we're doing a lot of things with electric vehicle safety there, with electric vehicle optimization, a lot of things with connected and autonomous vehicles there, and contract testing of all sorts in terms of, you know, like you mentioned, real world testing, engine testing, chassis dyno testing. And then the other big acquisition for Horiba was a company called FuelCon in Germany that makes all of the testing equipment required to develop batteries, battery packs, battery modules, and hydrogen fuel cells, right? Wow. So we've grown into that space as well.
Yeah, that's very interesting there. So you all are in the middle of that space also now, because we are in a transformative period in the transportation sector, aren't we?
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is honestly a 100-year transformation. I think this is the biggest transition like this that we've seen in transportation was probably when they went from the horse to the automobile in the 1910s. I mean, I think that's how big of a time of disruption we're going through right now.
Well, we're producing less fertilizer on the side of the road.
That's right. Yeah.
That's right. Well, Josh, anything else that you think is relevant here to our discussion today?
Yeah. You know, I'm really interested in what you said about the how we're producing energy. And I have no doubt that propane has a future there as well. You know, I think you and I talked briefly about the concept of microgrids and how the future of infrastructure is going to look. To me, that's a really, really important part of the future, and one where I'm sure propane plays a role, right? Is that if we really want to get to a cleaner future and one that's electrified in a smart way, an almost 100% overhaul of the infrastructure in this country is going to be necessary, and propane as an energy source, I would think, no doubt, has a big future there as well.
Well, that's exactly, Josh. I'm glad you brought that point up. I'm a great believer in on-site power or distributed generation. And speaking of 100-year technology, a centralized grid system where we generate power at a centralized location and then send it across transmission lines and lose a third of it. And by the time it gets to the plug, you get 32% of the energy that went into that plant. That's incredibly inefficient. Mm-hmm. And there are other ways to do it. And whether you're in a commercial building or a commercial facility or a residential home, putting solar panels on the roof and coupling it with the prime power generation system to produce all your electricity needs. When the sun's not shining, you've got the propane or even the natural gas unit producing it. You get the thermal energy off of that unit, which can be used for heating your home, for using your domestic hot water purposes. And you're really getting up into the 70% efficiency, more than doubling it versus a centralized model. Of course, that's going to be very challenging because you incumbent utilities. That's very disruptive. On-site power generation is very disruptive to the centralized grid model we've had in our country for going on 120 years. And
right. I
can see where somebody could plug their electric vehicle up, and it's coming from the power that their solar panels are producing, as well as when the sun's not shining or it's dark or whatever it may be, the backup, a prime power generation system. And the emissions reductions and the efficiency improvements are astonishing if we go that path, along with other technologies such as nuclear and nuclear fission and such things. So it's a long slog here, but right now the electric vehicle is the future, and I'm glad to see that your company, Horiba Automotive, is evolving along with it. And one last thing, Josh, we have we have this concept of electrification and transportation. It's going to be a great challenge. There's nothing wrong with the aspirational goals, but do you have any opinion, or do you have one of the things that we're working on is renewable propane? Our company has access to approximately 5 million gallons of renewable propane, which has a carbon intensity less than half of, for example, electric vehicle on average. Do you think renewable liquid fuels have any future? Or have you done any work in that area, or are you watching that evolve?
Yeah, I absolutely do. Not just renewable propane, but renewable natural gas, right? A lot of those renewable fossil fuels certainly have a big part of the future, right? And I personally think that you could make a lot of gains, sort of like what you were just saying, without trying to go 10 steps ahead to a fully electrified future where all of the power is generated from solar and hydro and nuclear, right? That's a step that's too big for us to take, right? In one step. But there are lots of gains you can be made by taking some intermediate steps that would pay immediate dividends, not just in making the environment cleaner, but also economically, right? And renewable fuels are absolutely going to be a big part of that. I'm a true believer in a diversity of solutions, right? There's no such thing as a one good idea will take care of everything. And that's just not going to happen in the near term, right? So we need all the good ideas to all work in the near term.
Well, in other words, as I often say, don't let the perfect get in the way of the very good.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I think that there's a real risk of chasing that perfect, and it's a net negative in the year term because we've lost sight of the very good. That's a great way of putting it.
Right. Well, Josh, Mark, do you have anything else for Josh today?
Yeah, the only thing I wanted to ask you, I was doing a little research on Hariba, and just a little fun fact. I watched your video, and your corporate motto is joy and fun. And I'd like you to just elaborate on that because, you know, ours is hard work and results.
Yeah.
It's all fun. We have a lot of fun.
Yeah. You know what? Hariba is a great place to work. And Mr. Hariba, Dr. Hariba, who was the founder, was truly one of those fascinating characters, right? You know, one of those people who seems to be writ large. And I, the concept there, to me, what it certainly means to me is that your job should not be something that you have to slog through for 45 or 50 hours a week. And you know, you grind to a halt Friday evening. Thank God the weekend is here, right? It's this whole idea of if you're doing something you love, you never work a day in your life. And I think that's what Hariba is trying to strike at, right, with that motto, is this idea that let's make our workplace enjoyable. Let's find ways that people can focus on things they believe in, that they truly enjoy. And then despite the fact that we are going to do a lot of hard work and hopefully have some resolve, it won't feel like it.
Yeah, that's great. Great motto and a great work life. Balance, I've never understood. If you don't enjoy your work, you're not going to enjoy life, right?
That's exactly right. If you don't enjoy your work, if you're even doing it for 5 hours a week, it's not a good balance.
That's right. That's right. Well, Josh, thank you so much for joining us today on Energy Unplugged. Really informative and helpful in us understanding how emissions testing is undertaken and some of the methods, the advancements that are being made here in the United States and also globally. We really appreciate you, and we wish you and your organization all the best as you go forward.
Yeah, thank you. Really excited to have been here today. Really can't thank you enough for having me on as a guest, and I wish you guys the best of success as well.
Thank you, Josh.
So we're going to be signing off as Energy Unplugged and hope you enjoyed it, and hope you share this with your friends. Take care.